session number 18569, Reel 2.
Colonel May, Reel 2.
Right. So, having been within 50 yards of the shells, we arrived on the German trenches while they were still at the bottom of the trench with their fingers in their ears, which is exactly what one wants to achieve. We in fact took a complete German company prisoner, two officers and about 70 soldiers. And the two officers were furious. They said the British never attack at this time. I think it was about 3 o'clock in the morning when we finally arrived on the objective. You never attack at this time of the day. We've had a perfectly bloody day, and we're having our 2 hours off. They were absolutely furious. I think, I'm not sure they didn't accuse us of cheating. Other thing that I learned of this first operation, by 8 o'clock in the morning, I was sitting on the edge of my trench, which was the third trench that I'd either started or completed during the night. And sitting on the edge of my trench, a shell burst in an apple tree about 5 yards away. And I can still remember noting that I had pushed off from the side of my trench and was waiting for gravity to take me towards the bottom. And I noticed that all my soldiers were considerably closer to the bottom of their trench than I was. And I can remember saying to myself, May, if you don't wake your ideas up, I'm not sure how much of a future you're going to have. Right. I don't know how much more you want to go on there.
Please, yes, carry on.
Well, we moved really from there and went elsewhere. And I mean, the only thing of interest really was that I was relieved by a platoon that consisted of an officer and 7 men. I wouldn't have been surprised if it had been 7 men, but I was surprised that the platoon of 7 men actually had an officer commanding it. He must have been very lucky. And his problem was that he was saying, how on earth am I going to fill all your trenches? Because I had a platoon of just under 30. And of course, the other trouble was, with only 7 men, he was pushed to carry the platoon's weapons. Because normally you've got 3 Bren guns and a mortar and a Piat anti-tank weapon, and they'd all need ammunition. So he was very pushed. But it indicates. He was in our sister battalion, 7th Somerset, and I know that they had a difficult attack during the day just before our night attack.
And then?
Right. Do you want to go into sort of big detail? I mean, the next time we were involved in something interesting, really, was the attack that we did on Zanton.
Please tell me about that.
We were set to clear a town called Zanton, which is on the west bank, or just inland from the west bank of the Rhine. And it was really the German sort of last town on the west bank of the Rhine in the British sector. And it had been attacked previously, but the attack hadn't succeeded. And one of our companies was did the initial attack, and there was an anti-tank ditch, and they had a very hard fight getting a bridgehead over this anti-tank ditch, because the anti-tank ditch severed the road, and they had flamethrowers, and they had a scissors bridge, so that the gap in the road could be bridged, and so vehicles could get across. The company I was with, A Company, together with another company, as soon as they'd got the bridgehead over this anti-tank ditch, we passed through them, either side of the main road, and we had the job of clearing up to the centre of the town. This involved each company clearing something like 30 houses, and the opposition were German parachutists. We unfortunately took some casualties, only to be expected if you're clearing houses. We had, well, certainly I had, working with me, a flamethrower, a crocodile flamethrower. I had never actually seen a tank before. In my training, I had never seen a tank. My company commander didn't believe in radio sets, so I didn't have a radio at all. I remembered that if you wanted to talk to a tank, my Precy had said you will find a telephone on the back of the tank, or you should find one. In fact, the telephone on my crocodile had been knocked off. Precy said, if there isn't a telephone, go round to the front of the tank and make faces at the driver, and he will pass a headset out through a porthole. So there came a time when I needed to talk to my tank, and so I went to the front, and sure enough, the headset was passed out through the porthole. Unfortunately, it was passed out on the side closest to the opposition. So one stood with one's back to the opposition and said, would you please sort out the house 20 yards behind me because it's being unfriendly, which it did. But one did feel a little exposed.
Why did your company commander not believe in radios?
I don't know. I didn't argue because, in fact, it meant one was left in peace to get on with things. One had been told what one was supposed to do. And he wasn't interfering with one while one was doing it. So it had advantages. unfortunately, I mean, I had started that particular battle with four NCOs in the platoon. I had a platoon sergeant and three section commanders. By halfway through the battle, I was down to my platoon sergeant and one section commander. So I only had two NCOs left in the platoon, which, because, and there wasn't anybody suitable to take over as section commanders. The soldiers were super, but they weren't necessarily NCOs. So what it meant was, each time we wanted to move a section, which didn't have a section commander, you went and collected it yourself and took it yourself. So by midday, when we'd actually got on to our objective, one was quite ready for a rest.
What was the house-to-house fighting like?
Basically, once one got into a house, people gave up. Or if it was obvious that you were going to get into the house, they disappeared elsewhere.
So was the opposition not very determined?
They had initially been very determined, but I think when they saw that they were losing, they thought discretion was the better part of valor, and to be available to fight another day.
Is this February or March?
This was early March, beginning of March. 8th of March, I think it was.
What was your opinion by now of the German soldier?
In general, they were, well, like all units, some were good, some were bad, or some were good and some were less good, shall we say. They didn't like, in general, the Germans didn't like fighting at night. And if you got round behind them, they would tend to pull out. They didn't tend to stay and fight the last rounds. But mind you, they had taken an awful pasting. This was 5.5 years into the war. There wasn't much of the German army left, and so there was considerable reason to try and retain units and not have them completely destroyed.
How did the English feel about fighting at night?
Oh, I mean, we were very happy to fight at night. We did, I was involved in three fairly formal battalion attacks. Fairly formal battalion attack. Three of those were at night. Zanten we fought in daylight. A battle in Lockham we fought in daylight. And basically everywhere else we fought at night.
So you captured Zanten in early March?
In early March, yes. But I think the infantry in general were getting very short of experienced NCOs. We were tending to be reinforced with anti-aircraft gunners converted into infantry, by RAF ground crew converted into infantry. And with the best will in the world, that is a fairly severe psychological change.
So how did these reinforcements perform?
They did everything they were asked to do, but I suppose it was about one in three who were actually looking for somebody to shoot. But I was interested, listening, I mean, I attend recently the realities of war at the Joint Services Staff College, their study. And General Hugh Pike, who was in the Falklands, he was giving one of the talks in the realities of war about the Falklands, and he put almost exactly the same proportion of soldiers who, rather than just doing what they were told, actually fought, which surprised me. However, that was in peacetime. Psychologically, one had been used to 5.5 years of war. And you know, people were more used to casualty rates. And you know, one knew as a platoon commander that even towards the end of the war, the life of a platoon commander was about 6 weeks. Not necessarily that that was how long he would live, but how long he would still be a platoon commander. One didn't think it would happen to you, but that was the average.
And after Zanton? What happened after Zanton?
After Zanton, we... just trying to think... We didn't do anything else then until we were involved in the crossing of the Rhine. Yeah, we weren't being used in the initial crossing of the Rhine. We were due to cross on the second night. And we, in fact, crossed as a battalion in Buffaloes, which, again, was an animal which I'd never seen before. And in fact, we got into our buffaloes in a water meadow just short of the river. My buffalo, I regret to say, started up while I was still climbing onto it and deposited me back, flat on my back in the water meadow, while my buffalo and platoon disappeared into the Rhine. And I was left hitching a lift on another. having got off out of the across the Rhine the other side, I managed to catch up with the platoon again. And we then marched a mile or so along the edge of the Rhine and went into a sort of concentration area in a field, very full. I mean, we were very cramped in the field, and I can remember marching the platoon into the field and giving a word of command I don't think one's ever likely to give again. We were in threes, marched into the field. I gave the command, halt, left turn, open order march, dig in. And we dug in threes. Open order march, and dug in threes. But I think the interesting thing is, one, every time one stopped moving with nothing to do, basically one dug in automatically. One never thought of doing anything else. One doesn't actually see many soldiers carrying picks and shovels these days. The next thing really of interest, we were stood by for various things, but eventually we weren't used until we were due to be launched on the breakout from the Rhine. And the night before we were due to do the breakout, we went into an assembly area in a wood that had been quite recently taken. Unfortunately, a German platoon, which was resident in the wood, hadn't got the message that it was due to be our assembly area. And we shared the wood during the night with them, which involved a certain amount of bickering between us as to whose wood it really was. But it didn't interfere with us all that much. One had to be a little careful while one was eating one's breakfast, but otherwise it was all right. And we set off in about 9 o'clock in the morning on the breakout from the Rhine as a great big long snake of armoured vehicles. And my platoon, like the whole of A Company, was travelling in kangaroos, which again was a vehicle I'd never seen before.
Was it there?
Kangaroo was basically a ram tank, a Canadian tank, which the turret had been taken out of, and about a section's worth of the platoon were in a hollow in the centre of the tank, and the only way you could get in and out was the hole where the turret had been. So if you wanted to get out, you had to climb out over the side. A Company was in fact towards the back of the column. There were various incidents further up the column, and as companies had been used, then they tended to move back to the back of the column or let people pass. As a platoon commander, I had no radio. There was no radio available to me in the kangaroo. And so one was in blissful ignorance in the inside of the kangaroo. If there was nothing happening, you could have your head out of the top and watch. But I don't think I've ever been quite as frightened as I was during that day, because at one stage we got stuck on a raised embankment, head to tail, so you couldn't get off the embankment and you couldn't go backwards or forwards. And I can remember watching an 88 shoot the top off the tree beside the kangaroo I was in. And all it only needed to come down a fraction and one was going to have a serious problem and nothing one could do about it. And there one was, with things going whang on the outside of the kangaroo and the top of the tree falling off. Not actually terribly good for morale.
Couldn't anybody do anything about the 88 millimetre?
Not at that stage, no. But in fact, we sorted it out later that night. We arrived in a, I think it was a little village, just short of a village called Varsseveld.
Called what?
Varsseveld in Holland. When we'd arrived, we were then about a mile short of where we thought the 88 or the 88s were. And in fact, I suppose we arrived there at about 6 o'clock in the evening, something like that. Dusk, anyway. Dark. Well, yes. And I was in fact sent out with a patrol almost immediately after we arrived to go and find the 88, which we managed to do, and we then came back and told the channel headquarters where they were, and we were then A Company, with myself leading, was told to go and get into that village. The whole battalion was going to be used, but we were due to leave because I discovered where they were. And so off we went, and we got to within about 30 yards of where these where we'd found the anti-tank, the 88, and we were having problems with wire fences, ordinary single strand, you know, 1, 2, 3 strands of single wire, and we were cutting those, but it's very difficult to do that silently, and for everybody to get over with all your equipment without making a noise. And when we were within about 30 yards, I decided that really the time had come when we had to stop being silent, because we weren't going to be able to be silent any longer. And we then did a noisy attack. And we didn't have any fire support at all, just ourselves. But we fired, everybody fired rapid, and people with automatic weapons fired probably about 1.5 to 2 magazines, and the riflemen fired about 7 or 8 rounds in covering the 30 yards